All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm here, as usual, talking to you from New York City on July 2nd, 2019. And we always like to remind you that I'm the editor of a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, and you can sign up for that letter by going to miningstocks.com. We want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Our sponsors for today's show, Klondike Gold, Noble Resources, RN Resources, Strike Point Gold, and Radisson Mining Resources. With regard to Radisson Mining, I would like to mention a fact that was missed last week when I interviewed Hubert Parent-Bouchard, of that company, of Radisson. He wanted me to note that, in fact, the company's management owns a big chunk of the company. Well, it's about 13%, which is a good size interest. And we always like to see companies, the managements of the companies that we recommend, having some skin in the game with these young companies that are really very very early on and a lot of risk involved. So if the management's ready to put their skin in the game, that's a comforting thought. At least it doesn't guarantee anything necessarily, but it's better to know that their actions will cost them something if they don't work out than if they're just playing with other people's money. So anyway, that's one of the positives for Radisson, and Radisson is up nicely today, as are most of the gold stocks, given the really nice move in the price of gold today. I wanted to mention to you that we're going to have Michael Oliver with us in just a moment, but today's show, the title of today's show is Adjusting Investment Themes to a Weaker Dollar. David McElvaney will be with us in the second half of the hour. John Tomazos, who's been with us once or twice in the past, one of the leading mining analysts on Wall Street through over many years, he'll be with us in the second segment, and Michael Oliver is with me now. The last time I talked to David McElvaney of McElvaney Wealth Management, he was of the view that the dollar was likely to get weaker, and he was turning pretty positive on gold. And we'd like to ask him, when we talk to David this afternoon, why he thinks that the dollar is going to be under some pressure. And obviously, since he made those remarks a couple of weeks ago, gold has really performed very well. It got smacked down pretty hard on Monday when it seemed like there could be some peace evolving between China and the United States from the G20. But that, of course, has changed. We saw today gold is up over $20, $23 or so before the start of today's show. But anyway, Michael, we have John, as I say, John Tomazos will be with me. He's really hot on iron ore right now and on the steel industry. John tracks the steel industry, and he'll explain where all the demand for steel is coming from and why the iron ore miners have done extremely well. And we'll want to find out from John whether he thinks I mean, they've had quite a good run. So, is there still more to come, or is the run pretty well over? We'll try to find out from John what his views are on that. But right now, we have Michael Oliver, and it's so good to know that he's with us once again. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Hi, Jay.
You know, I want to ask you about the dollar. I know it's not the market that you're most focused on at the moment. You have been somewhat bearish on the dollar. Do you see it sort of meandering around for a while, or do you see some weakness right ahead, or what is your view on the dollar
now? I think the recent weakness we've seen last month from the highs we made a month or two ago, talking dollar index now, up above 98, and it dropped down to under 96. Did it pretty rapidly. That break, though on a price chart, doesn't necessarily upset most people. From our momentum point of view, we broke too much stuff over the last few weeks. Now, we also look at quarterly momentum, which is a long-term metric, and we prefer to see monthly closes below trend structures on that particular time scale. And frankly, you're trading at levels now you can't close the month here because you'd be blowing that stuff out to the downside and adding to the negative technical. So, but yeah, we think the dollar has crested the secondary high. Its high of recent years was $103.50 on the dollar index, and our recent rally high was 98.20 area. And now we're trading down about two full points below there. So we think that secondary rally is now over. It did take its time. And what's most interesting that gold people should pay attention to, who are believers that if the dollar is strong, gold can't go up, is that the dollar index was at 97 on a sharp rally in August of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And basically from August of last year through last month, it was trading at or above or just below that level. You could draw a sideways line on the dollar. It wasn't doing anything except holding its gains. And yet gold went from the 1100s to 1400. So if you're waiting on the dollar as a signal indicator for gold, you missed one heck of a move.
Yeah.
Now if the dollar weakens, I think it'll add some wind at the back of gold. I think it will weaken. But it's not the only thing, okay?
No.
If it were, then gold wouldn't be where it is now.
Yeah, for sure.
And the stock market, I think, is also very pivotal here, especially U.S. stock market. S&P 500, we watch that, NASDAQ 100 very closely. And this rally we had on news, headline news, you know, buy the news, right? Okay.
Yeah.
If you did, you bought the S&P at the peak Monday morning at 29.77, cash index. And we're trading 10 or 15 points below there right now, no big deal, didn't collapse from that level. But it was interesting that day that they bought the news and went back into, quote, risk on, that T-bonds and gold, while they dropped, they immediately gained it back today. T-bonds are pressing at their highs, and gold's back near its highs.
Oh.
And the S&P's steady today. So how come it is that gold and T-bonds, which are, you know, inverse to the S&P and perceived as risk-off, how come they're back near their highs?
Yeah.
Everything's so glorious with the S&P. Well, I think the possible reason is that the trade tariff war coming off of the headlines and, you know, being retired as a scary dark cloud potentially removes one of the things that Powell has been talking about, and that is the Fed is concerned about the uncertainties, and that's a big uncertainty. And that could disturb the economy, and therefore the Fed has to watch that China thing. Well, if the China tariff war is off now, or at least put in the back burner, then one of those uncertainties is off the page, and therefore the Fed has less reason to cut rates. So think about that if you're long the stock market. You know, the good news about the tariff war is also inversely impacting the S&P based on the rate outlook, the Fed not moving quickly.
Yeah, so, it's a strange world.
Yeah. S&P I'd watch very closely here. I don't think it can afford even a 1% drop from here. If you drop about 1%, we put out a report today with very specific numbers. I won't reveal them. But basically, you can't afford to wobble here if you're long because there's some stuff you're going to break that could get this thing rolling on the downside again. And that's just what the bulls don't want to see. They've seen so many umpteen new marginal highs over the last year or so that don't go anywhere. They're pretty soon they may give up on it.
Well, yeah, you would think so. It looks like a gigantic topping process that's been going on for the last, what, a couple of years or so, it seems. And I've seen these patterns before. It seems like not very positive. I want to ask you about, I think you indicated that you did some, you looked very quickly at a couple of iron ore companies. And as I mentioned in my introductory remarks that we're going to be talking to John Tomazos, he's seeing the iron ore markets just on fire. What are you seeing with a couple of the major iron ore companies?
I ran, before we came on, I ran BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto. And they're both quite strong, but their breakout levels, from our vantage point anyway, were many months ago at much lower price levels. So, you know, if you're already in, fine. It looks like, frankly, there could be some more upside. But it's not, from our vantage point, and again, looking at two of the leaders, we see it as an extended move that really began from much lower levels, and so it's not a place to initiate brand new positions, in our view. It doesn't mean it can't go higher. It's just, you know, the ground level, entry level has been passed, and now your risk-reward is shifted. I'm not saying they're topping here, but they definitely have had a good run, and that should factor into anybody who wants to. Now, there may be some market symbols within this sector that have not had a good run. Vail, for example, has been under pressure for various reasons unique to itself. Right. And there's some probably lesser iron ore companies that might not have done what BHP and Rio did. But it's one of these situations where, yes, it's positive, but it's not ground floor entry level.
Okay, Michael, what about GDX right now, getting back to the gold sector? And you've indicated before you think that we'll really see the gold shares start to gain some strength. Yep. If the equity market in general gets weaker, you know, people will be looking for another place to put their money where they can make some money. What are your thoughts about GDX right now?
Well, our technical work on GDX has validated what we've been saying for many, many months over the last year or so, that when the gold bull gets reborn again in the way that the public sees it as reborn, and that was in crossing that mid-1300 level, and that woke most people up finally who only look at price charts, what happened to GDX doubled and better what gold did. And the spread relationship between the miners and gold has now broken out of a multi-year basing action, indicating that we've just begun the shift such that the miners, which have been weaker, anemic, compared to gold over the last couple of years, that's changed. And it changed like a light switch, and it changed several weeks ago. And we think, therefore, going forward, the better place to be in the gold sector are the miners. At this point, the major miners be reflected by GDX. The junior miners are still lagging, but I suspect at some point as we gain more and more strength in the gold market, that lesser sector will rise as well in terms of relative performance to gold. But it's evident to me, at least, that I can't see who bought what, but the money flows into the gold miners has changed dramatically over the last 4 weeks. You can see it on a price chart. It's like they stuck a cattle prod on it. It just went vertical. Went from just above 20 on the GDX up to over 26 in 4 weeks.
Yeah, there's tremendous flows of money going into the gold ETFs, I know. that's really interesting. And is there any hope at all for silver?
Yep. In fact, we're not across the numbers yet. We have some very specific numbers above the silver markets, a handful of percentage points, and we've defined them and adjusted them for the new quarter. That if silver engages those numbers, we think silver will bolt higher dramatically, and with a tone that it has not exhibited in a long time. So like a light switch again, just what GDX did over the last 4 weeks, I expect that out of silver, and I think silver will at that point in time when we cross those hurdles and their momentum-based trend structures, when we engage those structures, I think silver will just become a different animal and become far more violent on the upside. And so it should be like a light switch event where people who are accustomed to seeing silver behave in a certain way will be shocked for what happens. Yeah. And I would say it's almost an inevitability. When I see these type of momentum bases built, as silver has, it's a base that basically I would say is inverse to the topping pattern in 1929 on the Dow and the topping pattern in 87 before the crashes. It is a very potent-looking structure.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have to leave it go at that. It's an exciting time. It's OliverMSA.com, and folks, now that gold and silver are starting to really catch on, you might want to consider taking out Michael's subscription that focuses on the gold and silver sector. You might also add that there are a lot of several silver companies that I'm extremely bullish on that I'm following in my newsletter. If you want to take out a subscription to my letter, I think you'll be very pleased once these markets really start to turn. And there aren't that many silver producers, but there's a couple that I track that are really, really good and very much under the radar screen of most investors. Michael, thank you so much for being with us again. Always a pleasure having you. Folks, don't go away. I'm going to be right back with John Tomazos, the independent mining analyst, John Tomazos, one of the best and most highly regarded analysts, mining analysts on Wall Street for many years. So we'll be right back with John Tomazos.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Karratha region of Western Australia, where they are currently drilling and trenching their Perdes Reward Project. In addition, Noble has partnered with Sumitomo Mining Corporation to advance its Beaton's Creek Gold Project toward production. With over $70 million in cash and strong shareholder support from the likes of Kirkland Lake Gold, Noble is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
StrikePoint Gold, trading under SKP on the TSX and STKXF on the OTC, has a market cap of under $10 million. StrikePoint is a new player in the Golden Triangle of BC and Canada. Focus will be on drilling the Willoughby Project in 2019. Prior drilling delivered over 20 meters of 25 grams per ton gold and 184 grams per ton silver. Recent receding glaciers have identified new gold targets. Neighboring projects have been acquired by StrikePoint's largest shareholder, Ascot. Eric Sprott and Skeena round out the other top shareholders.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me, once again, John Tomazos. He's been with me a couple of times in this show. He is a very well-known mining analyst on Wall Street over many years. He's currently independently employed and running his own business, and he's continuing to do what he's really good at, and that is mining, analyzing mining projects and the markets and all manner of, not just the precious metals, which your host is focused mostly on, but John is much involved in a number of very important global markets, and it's the very independent research.com, veryindependentresearch.com, and the name is very fitting because John Tomazos is very independent, and that's why we like to have him on the show. Thanks for joining me again, John.
Jay, it's an honor to be your guest.
It's really great to have you, and I want to have you just talk a little bit, take a minute to tell our listeners what you do, who your service is meant for, and how those who may be able to benefit from your service can avail themselves to it.
Well, certainly. From 1979 to 2007, I worked for large Wall Street firms. I ranked on the Institutional Investor All-American team for various metals categories, I think 43 times. And unfortunately, in June of 2007, I was working for Prudential, which shut down its brokerage division. And I just kept writing my research reports for my old institutional clients, and 31 bought my service the first year. Mm-hmm. So for 12 years, I've been publishing 19 on average detailed investment reports about precious metals, base metals, forest products, and fertilizers. Mm-hmm. And I basically operate like an institutional research boutique without a big bank. Institutions can buy my service for $25,000 a year and get all my stuff. Or individuals can go to my website, veryindependentresearch.com/buy our reports and mm-hmm. buy individual reports for $500 a piece, such as iron ore mm-hmm. from May or Fortescue Metals from May that I'm going to talk about in our conversation today.
Right. So let's jump right into it, John. The iron ore markets have been on fire. I couldn't believe it. I saw a chart here. They were up something like 53% over the last 6 months. What's driving that market in a time when the global economy seems to be weakening?
So world steel production rose 6.2% in 2017 and rose 4.6% in 2018, where March last year, rest of world ex-China set a record.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, through May, world steel production is up 5%, where China is all the growth and rest of the world has shrank a tiny bit this year.
Mm-hmm.
So the three-year cumulative growth is 16.6%, or almost 300 million tons of steel, and a ton of molten iron, virgin iron, needs 1.6 tons of iron ore. So iron ore demand has grown about 400 million tons in 3 years.
Wow.
And the iron ore price bottomed at $38 in December of 2015, and the iron ore companies stopped planning new expansions. The four large iron ore companies' mines really consist of three departments: the mine, the railroad, and the port.
Mm-hmm.
And Rio Tinto, BHP, and Fortescue, the major iron ore miners, are port-constrained. And Vale has 100, 150 million tons of extra ports, but they don't have permits to operate 62.8 million tons of their Minas Gerais output because they had two accidents in 2015 and in January this year that killed 19 and almost 300 people, respectively.
Wow.
And Vale has a 50% owned operation called Samarco that's a JV with BHP that had the accident 4 years ago. It's 28 million tons and has not been able to restart.
Wow.
So let's talk a little bit, Jay, about Chinese demand for steel.
Yeah, that's where
their
it's coming
auto
from, right?
Sales are down 12% in the first half of this year after falling 2.8% last year. Their property market, their construction market in the private sector seems to be going sideways. They don't need to be building new steel mills and aluminum and other things and new export factories because of tariff and trade war concerns. They've taken half of world manufacturing. They're 54% of steel, 56% of aluminum, 35% of autos, and growing quickly. So crudely, China is about half of world manufacturing today, and the rest of the world's starting to starve. So the entire growth in steel demand in China, or over 100% of it if the private sector is shrinking, is public. And let me call public four things.
Mm-hmm.
Military, civil public works like roads. Thirdly, roads outside of China through Pakistan all the way west to the Mediterranean, what they call their Silk Road Project.
Sure.
They want to export goods to the rest of the world or maybe run their military like Hitler did and have a good road system.
Mm-hmm.
And then fourthly, they're doing all kinds of electricity and water and port and road public works projects in Africa because they want the copper and other metals and resources from Africa. So the U.S. had peak steel concrete reinforcing bar shipments in 2006 of 9.8 million short tons. China's steel output is 40% rebar, where ours is 8 or 9% rebar.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing about 360 million metric tons of rebar this year, or about 45 times more rebar than the U.S.
Wow.
Let me suggest those man-made islands in the South China Sea take a lot of rebar. Maybe they're building some military things that are going to be bunker bomb-proof because they're more steel than concrete.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the private sector. It's the public sector in China that's sucking up all this steel. I have no way of knowing how much it goes up or down or sideways or continues, but it's up 10.2% this year.
Wow. It's
so
very strong.
The iron ore price was $75 before Vale's disaster in January 25th,
mm-hmm.
and it's risen steadily every month. The metal bulletin price this morning for 62% iron ore is $125.77. And I like to read the Chicago Mercantile Exchange because it's in U.S. dollars, not Chinese yuan. Mm-hmm. And this morning it was $119.45. The metal bulletin price is the wide benchmark. It's up, basically, it's up $50 since January 25th. Now, wow. The market realized iron ore was short when Vale had their catastrophe.
Right.
And the government shut Vale down half in Minas Gerais State. But I think the bigger factor has been the 300 million ton rise in world steel demand. And then also Rio Tinto missed 15 million tons of output, and BHP and Fortescue missed a few million tons each. They had cyclones in March. So iron ore is great. And don't be confused by the aluminum or the copper or the nickel charts. That's something else.
All right, so John, with just a few minutes left, you seem to favor Fortescue as the way to play this, and if so, why, and how much do you think is left? I mean, it's hard to say how long this could go on, I guess.
So Fortescue Metals makes 58% grade iron ore for most of their sales, which 1 or 2 years ago was discounted $30 to benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
And Fortescue's discount shrank $15 and might be shrinking to only $10. So the iron ore price is up $40 and Fortescue's price is up $15 more.
Hmm.
So Fortescue is a $6.42 stock today. The NASDAQ ticker is FSUMF. There also is a second NASDAQ ticker, FSUGY, that's a 2-for-1 ADR.
Mm-hmm.
The ordinary shares paid a 21-cent dividend U.S. in the December half year. They earned 21 cents U.S. in the December half year.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't reported their June half year yet, but they declared and paid a 62-cent dividend.
Wow.
So the stock yields 10% for the June half year that was $75 in January, and I don't think they averaged 110 in June.
Huh. Wow.
So they also suffered cyclones, hurricanes in March, and lost several million tons of shipments. So it looks like they're going to be able to pay a $1 dividend in the December half year.
Wow.
And the stock is $6.42. Now, I do a discounted cash flow NPV model, Jay,
mm-hmm.
to value the company. I use a 10.5% discount rate, an $80 benchmark.
Mm-hmm. For your numbers.
It's $125 today.
Huh. Yeah.
And my net present value model that I calculated on May 15 and haven't updated was $11.45.
Hmm.
I'm a very conservative person.
Yeah, I know you are.
If I used $100 and a 9% discount rate, $100 for 62% benchmark instead of 80, it's 125 today. And if I used a 9% discount rate, I think I'd get a $20 U.S. target for the $6.42 stock. Now, this company is yielding over 20% dividend, annualizing the 62 cents they just paid. It's going to go up. And it's in Western Australia, which is a lovely, lovely place. If you ever want to take a vacation in Perth, it's a wonderful place. The dolphins swim next to the ocean, and there's beautiful beaches to the south of Perth where Alcoa exports alumina. Beautiful white sandy beaches. And this company has $13 a ton direct cost for iron ore, even though the price is $125 today.
Wow.
And their balance sheet is normal. So this isn't some funky company that's about to collapse.
Yeah.
The market just doesn't understand how good iron ore has gotten. And that instead of getting discounted, Fortescue is paid in full for the 58%. So this stock could be a triple bagger collecting this dividend.
Yeah, incredible. John, we're going to have to leave it go at that because we're out of time. I knew you were very excited about this. I wanted to hear about it. I wanted our listeners to hear about it. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to tell us about it. And we'll look to have you back on when you have another great idea like this. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for the honor of being your guest.
You bet. Thank you, John. All right, folks, well, don't go away. We got to go to break, but David McElvaney will be with us. We're going to talk to him about his views on the dollar and these various markets. David has some ideas also about where to go, what kind of investments to make in a weaker dollar environment. So don't go away. We'll be right back with David McElvaney.
Auron Resources is a copper gold exploration company pursuing the world's next major discoveries. It has seven projects, including two active flagships, Committee Bay in northern Canada and Sombrero in southern Peru. This summer will be one of the most exciting times in Auron's history as the company turns the drill at Sombrero for the first time ever. The project's impressive surface results have identified Sombrero as an analog to one of Peru's biggest mines. Auron is also implementing cutting-edge machine learning technology to unlock its highly prospective gold belt at Committee Bay. Visit AuronResources.com and subscribe to keep up with the company's busy year ahead.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon Territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again David McElvaney. David has a very impressive academic background and a professional career in the financial industry. And from what I know, it isn't only his background and experience and expertise in the markets that brings him value, brings his clients value, but of equal importance is a culture of honesty and integrity that he has implanted at McElvaney Wealth Management and the other related companies. Along with that integrity comes an ability to think outside of the box that others would always like to enslave us in, it seems. So often anyway, we're not supposed to think, we're just supposed to follow the leaders, as they say. And so it's really great to have David with me again. Thanks for joining me, David.
Jay, great to be with you.
Always good to have you with me, and I titled today's show, Adjusting Investment Themes to a Weaker Dollar. But before we get more specifically to that show, I'd like to just mention last week on your McElvaney Weekly Commentary podcast, the theme of your discussion was gold's rapid rise. Is it guns, parentheses Iran, or butter, parentheses devaluation? Perhaps you could just talk to us a little bit about the theme of that show and what you talked about, some of the topics that might have gone into last week's podcast. And I'd like to recommend to our listeners that they check in with you, I think, every week, and you've got one coming up tomorrow that will be loaded up on your website, I believe. Is it M Wealth well, is it the site to go to is mwealth.com, mwealthm.com?
You know, if you just go to McIlvaney.com, you can link to any of our pages, which would include the wealth management or the commentary. So just the last name, McIlvaney.com. So guns and butter, you know, the different take on the Johnson administration days. Yeah, we have some concerns about what's developing with Iran. And obviously the idea of devaluation, we got to see the debates, the Democratic primary debates, and it was all a number of ways in which we can spend money that we don't necessarily have to take care of people who have an infinite number of needs. So the potential domestically in terms of fiscal policy is there for devaluation. Competitive devaluation in terms of trade could be a theme that develops. What we see in the gold market today is a safe haven bid. It's moving along with treasuries and boons and other paper that's desirable from a safe haven standpoint. And so, you know, you're kind of caught on the horns of a dilemma because on the one hand, gold is getting some interest. And on the other, it's not necessarily the case that it would continue to be with a weak dollar in mind. Yes, over a long period of time, you've got a negative correlation of 0.85 dollar to gold. So it would make sense that a weak dollar would signify strong gold prices moving forward. But there are periods of time where you see, like we have in recent weeks, safe haven buying of gold, in which case there really is no relationship to the dollar. You could have a strong dollar on the basis of people moving into treasuries because they're yielding more than other central banks, which are yielding less than nothing.
Yeah.
And at the same time, gold continues to motor higher because it's desirable as a safe haven asset. So I don't think the long-term success or maybe this period of success for gold requires a weaker dollar, although we can certainly make that case.
Yeah, it's actually Michael Oliver, who was with us during the first segment, pointed out that it's been some time now. I can't remember exactly the time frame in which the dollar has been stable, hasn't gone down, and gold has risen from, you know, under 1,200 to where it is now. So it certainly is true. I also would like to mention, again, it's for people to listen to your weekly commentary, because I think it's so good. It's usually about a half an hour in length, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I understand that you just recorded another one this morning that will be uploaded on your website tomorrow. Is that right? And if that is right, could you maybe give our listeners a hint of what the topic will be for the one that will be loaded tomorrow?
Sure. It is going to be loaded tomorrow. And we talked about a variety of things. I mean, we're definitely interested in the disconnect between the stock market moving higher and as if there's nothing to be concerned about while you're still seeing lots of traffic into the safe haven assets.
Right.
And so yields continuing to go lower and lower, bond prices continuing to go higher, indicating strong demand. And it just means that you've got investors on the one hand who see no problems on the horizon, and another set of investors who definitely see problems on the horizon. That same divergence between equities and bonds was occurring in 2007, where you began to see yields decline, even while stocks were motoring higher as if it were 1999 all over again. So I think we're setting the stage for a significant decline in equities, and the only guys who are going to be surprised are your equity investors. But as it's been said by many investor professionals before, the equity crowd gets it last.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it seems to be the case, and you know, you can usually go with the bond markets, I think, long-term, and you're probably going to be right. It seems that it's kind of a disconnect that we have here that would certainly what my thinking is. On your June 21st weekly commentary, not the podcast, but you also have a weekly commentary in which you sort of summarize the week and what's happened and how you see the markets at that point in time, you and your team, you wrote, and I quote, "These are truly remarkable times for hard assets. We are finally beginning to see signs that King Dollar is joining the race to the bottom in a global currency devaluation war." And so I'd like to ask you, what are you seeing that causes you to believe that? Because if we are going to have some sort of a market collapse, I think very often the dollar tends to get stronger, at least in the short run, because people are covering their, you know, the margin clerk calls and you have to sell assets to gain the cash to pay your debts. So what are you seeing that causes you to believe that the dynamics may be for a decidedly weaker dollar, or just I don't know, what are your views in terms of how much weaker we might see the dollar and what might be the dynamics that lead to a weaker dollar.
Well, you're right to frame things in terms of short-term and long-term. I think the long road for the dollar is a very weak and painful road. Short-term, it can do anything on a trading basis. But what we see is really a fight for hegemony, and we've maintained the world's reserve currency status for many decades following World War II. We're beginning to see strides towards the rest of the world saying maybe the old monetary regime is not what the new or future monetary regime should be or will be. And, you know, INSTEX is certainly one move towards tearing apart the advantages we've had being the world's reserve currency. And the main participants in that are the French, the Germans, the British. And these are folks that we consider reliable trade partners and on the same page with in many respects. But they, too, I think would see dollar reserve status is something that's not as important moving forward. So what would we do to maintain our place in the world? Would we voluntarily engage in a competitive devaluation? It's fascinating to me to listen to Donald Trump because on the one hand, he'll criticize Mario Draghi's policies for weakening the value of the euro and giving them a trade advantage, or for the Chinese for that matter. But if we weaken our currency, somehow that's okay with him. Yeah. So very much a double standard today. And if it brings us an advantage, we will do it. And I think from his vantage point, increasing our share of the global GDP pie may include the choice to devalue. So that's also an opportunity or an option that we may see exercised in the next 4 to 6 years.
Yeah, it's concerning the European relationship that we have had since World War II, especially. It seems to me that there is growing discontent with the American policy, certainly towards Iran, for example. And I've read where there's some efforts on the part of Iran and some of the European allies to find a way around the sanctions that President Trump is trying to impose on them, including a way around the SWIFT system or a payment system outside of the SWIFT system. Do you know anything about that? Have you heard or read anything about that?
Yeah, well, that's what I was mentioning with the INSTEX, I-N-S-T-E-X. That is right. The workaround for both the trade of goods and commodities, as well as the movement of assets, which circumvents SWIFT. And, you know, we're in the process of going after the Chinese as we speak, three banks that are doing business with North Korea, and the threat, the sword, if you will, of Damocles that hangs over the Chinese heads is we're going to cut you out of the flow of capital via the SWIFT system. And the Chinese response is, okay, and if that system proves to be problematic, maybe we just need to engineer our own system. So, I mean, we push, and at a certain point, I think we find that the energy we put into pushing could be used against us in almost a sort of jujitsu-style move where our energy and our weight are all of a sudden a liability. We're trying to push people around, but it's used against us, and I think that's probably the case with SWIFT moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And I still remember when President Obama was trying to push through the agreement with Iran, and Secretary of State Kerry was warning a group of businessmen that if that treaty wasn't approved or if it didn't go forward, that a lot of the European nations would become very unhappy with this. And he said there was a ready talk and discontent among our allies about the hegemony of the dollar and how they'd like to see it displaced or at least not as dominant as it has been. So yeah, it seems to me that we could really be looking at some major changes, David, in terms of the global monetary system, especially if we have any kind of really serious economic decline again, as we had in 2008, 2009. Wasn't it then when the Chinese and the Russians and others started to look for ways to protect themselves from the next sort of decline that might be coming their way, right?
That's right. It certainly opened their minds to doing things in a different way. In an ironic twist, it would seem that a real outright global depression would shift the balance back towards us. You know, we've got the sort of incumbent advantage. We've got the dollar safe haven status. And if things get bad everywhere else, they're kind of the least worse here in the United States. You've heard the dollar being the cleanest, dirty shirt, as even right. Ian McCavity used to describe it, the best looking horse in the glue factory. But you, truly, in a moment of panic and crisis, what currency do you want to be in? All of a sudden, this underscores our role, the importance of the U.S. dollar. And so real turmoil could be our saving grace, at least in the short run.
So if all the currencies in the world are headed lower, doesn't really matter as long as the dollar isn't the one that goes the most low.
Well, I think for anyone who's not paying attention to real assets, and this is where hard assets and our focus on the wealth management team with hard assets and the focus of cash flow relating to hard assets, or the actual metal itself, our sister business dealing in precious metals brokerage for 47 years now, you see the gradual devaluation, the competitive devaluation, the relative, the absolute loss in currencies when you focus on real things. It's when you're locked in the relative value game where it looks like the dollar's doing better relative to the euro, relative to the yen, but they could all be on a downward slide, just some sliding at a slower pace than others. Well, I think that's the importance of having some sort of reference point, some sort of a plumb line, some sort of an absolute value in the equation so that you know where you're at and don't get sucked into the devaluation game.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that. I believe in one of your recent podcasts, you talked about some of, I think, the Malaysian prime minister and other leaders are really seeming to focus on gold and going back to a gold-backed currency, providing that plumb line, as you say, I guess, for the rest of the world. So we have some reference point of value. Do you see a realistic chance of some sort of a commodity-backed monetary system? Do you think that's a reality, or is that just a pipe dream of a lot of gold bugs?
Well, I think when you look at Mahathir Mohamad in Malaysia, he's been a long-term proponent of gold and gold being a part of a currency system, whether it is, you know, relating to the Islamic world or it's relating, as he's most recently mentioned, becoming a part of an Asian regional trade currency. There's nothing new from him. He's long been a fan. There might be an openness to that in Asia for trade-related issues. I think a broad-based acceptance of gold by the central bank community is a low probability because it introduces disciplines into a system where they have they've come to enjoy the freedoms of really arbitrary decision making. They don't tie their decisions to rules. They pretend to base their decisions on numbers. But the old disciplines of the gold standard are long gone, and they would never voluntarily take them back. So perhaps on the other side of a global currency devaluation, you end up with a return to gold. But it has taken extreme negative circumstances for the man in the street to demand the disciplines, and only then do they come back. That's really the history of the gold standard. It's there, it's lost, the paper currency system gets screwed up, and then they demand to bring it back. So popular demand for gold could do it, but we don't have the circumstances or the level of pain experienced by the man in the street necessary to, again, in a sort of populist shift, demand that kind of a discipline. Not yet.
All right, David. So without a plumb line, we can be pretty sure that the purchasing power of currencies around the world will continue to decline. And so that plumb line is gold for many of us. Maybe it's real estate. It's something that's real that can't be devalued away. Recently, I think it was on your June 21st, weekly commentary, you provided some ideas about what you as a portfolio manager may be doing in terms of adjusting to a weaker dollar, a dollar that becomes weaker than it has been relative to other currencies. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what your thinking is? What are some of the sectors? I'm sure gold is one of them, but what are some of the ideas that you have in terms of maybe some good places to put your money in a weaker dollar environment?
Well, this is the challenge, because when you start looking for ways of hedging against a weaker dollar, you tend to move towards commodities, and then you embrace a cyclicality to the pricing of those commodities, which, let's say, for instance, you're 65, 75, 85, or 55 and thinking about retirement, that kind of price cyclicality can be very unnerving. So the key, I think, within the portfolio management space, and what we've tried to do, is focus on income generation, where some of that income is generated to infrastructure and real estate, as well as commodities, to help balance out the cyclical nature of the commodity movement. And the nice thing about having an income component, let's say you're able to create a yield of between 3% and 5%, is you're being paid to wait, and some of the cyclicality in the commodity pricing is less of an issue, because you're moving towards a total return equation, part of it income, part of it capital gains, versus, frankly, most commodity plays are just beneficial on a capital gains basis. So shifting focus to total returns, shifting focus to income, I think that's the way I would harness some of the energy of those spaces. But again, we want to focus on real things. So imagine the old idea of owning a toll road. Well, okay, it's not gold, but it is a real thing with cash flow. And so if you can target real things that have cash flow in complement to a gold position, now I think you're talking. And now I think you're talking about a portfolio that not only provides growth and upside potential, but again, removes some of the frustrations that come with price cyclicality in just a pure commodities play.
Yeah, so it could be something like a pipeline or something like that that could provide. So what are some of the other ideas? I noticed that you talked about lumber, I think, was one of your ideas. Could you talk to us a little bit about what might make lumber attractive?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's the risk of, you know, are they building houses at a particular point in an economic cycle or business cycle? Are they using, you know, the trees for pulp? Is there as much demand for paper? What I like about timber is that it's something that's growing. Think of it in terms of sort of an internal rate of return at about 7% a year, given the growth in the asset itself. So when you have water, soil, and the wood that's growing, it literally, its board footage is growing typically at about a 7% rate. Mm-hmm. You may not be harvesting it, you may not seeing the benefit, but there is, let's call it, for lack of a better term, organic growth with something like timber. And so over a long period of time, it's a real asset that has an internal growth component. And you can decide when and how to harvest when pricing is more favorable to you.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, with regard to gold, on your June 21st discussion, your written discussion, you said you were cautiously optimistic, and I think gold has performed very nicely since that June 21st comment. What are your thoughts now? Is it overdone a bit in the short run, do you think? We might see a pullback.
Still cautiously optimistic. If you're looking at the charts, certainly a break above the 1365 and above 1400. These are helpful points. But what we have yet to see is follow through from silver. The gold-silver ratio as recently as last week was, you know, 92 and change. And so without that follow through, it certainly leaves the possibility of kind of a false breakout on gold. So we'll have to see. We started by talking about gold in terms of the safe haven bid. The buying has neglected silver because silver is not as reliable as a safe haven bid. If you get into a scenario where gold is moving and there's an audience for it, a growing audience, then silver will play catch up. Silver will participate at some point, but there can be periods of time where silver is just not treated the same. It's viewed for its industrial commodity status and not as a purely monetary metal as gold typically is. And so that to me is still concerning. Love to see follow through there. And if you look at the gold mining equities, very little follow through there. For all the move in gold from the 1200s to 1400, you haven't seen the kind of multiplied growth in a lot of your names. Now, there have been a few outperformers, but I think those have earned it on their own management merits and asset merits, not necessarily just as a proxy for the price, as a leveraged proxy for the price. No speculators have really come into the gold share space as of yet, and I would like to see that as a form of investor dollar follow-through.
Right. New money coming into the sector would be nice.
Yep.
Does McIlvany Wealth Management, do you as part of your portfolio strategy, own some gold mining companies by any chance?
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is where, it's taken us 5 decades to build an amazing team. And at this point, our team consists of some of the best analysts in the natural resource space, some of the best analysts in the credit space. And so when it comes to both analyzing company-specific opportunities in the natural resource space or recognizing specific risks inherent to the structural issues within the financial system, man, I'm incredibly proud of our wealth management team.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it go at that because my engineer tells me we're out of time. David, it's so good to have you back again. It sounds like something our listeners should check out. So it's McIlvany.com, I believe is what you told me.
That's right. Or our website for the wealth management group is mwealthm.com. M as in Mary.
Mwealthm.com.
That's correct.
Excellent. Very good. Well, thank you so much, David, for being with us. We'll hope to have you back again soon. Folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, Alistair McLeod will be with me, and Sean Kuhn of Strike Point Metals. Also expect Michael Oliver will be with us once again. Until next week, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.